Is that a timer?
Yeah, we're recording.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow, spotlight. Hello, everybody. My name is Leslie.
Hi, Leslie.
And I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon Fellowship. Wow. I was not grateful when I came in here, that's for damn sure, but over the years, it sure has panned out good for me. I came in January 3rd, 1987. And I was raised in Texas, you know, in San Antonio, and I didn't have any alcoholism in my family that I knew of. And I'll explain a little more later on about that. The only alcohol I saw in our house was when my uncle came up from Corpus Christi, Texas. He was a chief at the naval base down there, and he'd come up to bring his bottle of booze and lay it on the counter in the kitchen, and he'd bring his big old carton of Winston cigarettes and double mint gum, and I thought he was so cool, nice shiny brown shoes and all, you know. And but that was the only time I really saw any alcohol in my family. Dad drank a beer once in a while, very rare. Mom got drunk once, Dad's fault. He fed her some Southern Comfort, which is a sweet drink, and she didn't really realize how strong it was, and she got sick off of that. That was the last time she ever touched any of that stuff. But that's the extent of any alcohol in my family. My brother got involved with a friend called named Ted, and Ted was a daily user of heroin, and he had gotten my brother to try it out a couple times, and my brother told me about it, and I threw a big fit over it, and I told him, I said, you know, you keep doing this, you know, I'm not going to be your brother anymore, and I can't handle this. And I think a divine intervention stepped in, and Ted overdosed and died. That scared my brother enough to get back on a normal human life. Other than that, that's all the traumatic stuff that went on when I was early in Texas. I joined the Navy right out of high school. Before I left there, though, I used to go around partying with my friends, and we'd go to the Kegers, and that's where you meet the girls, you know, or you'd crash parties, you know, and that's where I met my first wife. Well, what can I say? You know, I mean, it's just the way it was. And then I joined the Navy, like I said. And they shipped me over to Japan. I was over there the first year. I came back here, and I married my high school sweetheart. I took her back to Japan, trying to start a new life. And we'd go out to sea 30 to 60 days at a time. I was on a 7th Fleet flagship, and we would do a lot of goodwill tours to different ports. And we'd come back in, and the wives would usually meet us on the pier. Well, one time we came back in from a 60-day trip out, and she was not there, and I figured, well, she probably just didn't get the news that we were in. And so I got Liberty, got a cab, went home. I lived off base in a little apartment, and walked in the apartment, and there was nothing there. It was completely empty. No furniture, no pots and pans. The only thing that was there was my clothes in the middle of the room, piled neatly with a note on top of it saying she didn't love me anymore, she wanted a divorce, and that she found somebody else on the base. Now, that was a big self-esteem hit to me there. And when I was a little kid, I was short and fat, and I used to follow my brother around, and I got a self-esteem problem there because they used to call me names and throw rocks at me. Now, I'm not looking for sympathy, because when I grew up, I beat the crap out of all of them. But, you know, and that's just the way it was. And, but I did carry that self-esteem problem with me, and it suited me well for a while, you know. I decided to, when I got out of the service, I extended after I sent her home. I extended in the Navy. And a couple of friends I met, we decided to buy motorcycles when we got out and travel the United States and find new places, you know, and see new women and find out what's going on in the United States. So that's exactly what we did. Got out, traveled the United States. We went down a southern route, went through Tallahassee, Florida. And when we were in there, we heard there was this music festival around on the Suwannee River. So we went up there. this music festival, and I met this young lady. She lived in a commune, and she said, "You want to come on over?" And I said, "Sure." You know, so we went over to the commune there, and then everything was happening that you would think would happen in a commune, and then some. And I clicked pretty good with this young lady, and I asked her, I said, "Would you like to travel around the United States with us on motorcycles?" And she said, "Yes." So, very surprising. So we took off, you know, a day or two later, and we zigzagged back and forth on the East Coast, hitting different states and different things to look at, and came across the top of the United States, same thing. I went up into Wisconsin and Minnesota, came back down and ran out of money and ran out of summer. So we had to get jobs in Chicago. My buddy's got a job at this paint factory in North Chicago, and I got a job at a chrome factory, plate and chrome, down in downtown Chicago. Now, I went to work one morning, and they had burned that shop down to the ground. The local yokels did not like the fumes in their neighborhood, and they took good care of that shop. So I had to end up getting a job, and I applied for the job as a forklift driver at the paint factory where my buddies were working. That was a pretty fun job, you know. I got to drive a forklift and fill the orders of the painters, you know, the pigment and resin and all that. And out in the Quonset hut where all this pigment is, you know, it's just like powder on the floor. So you can race up and down there with your forklift and slide and have a good time. So I imagine if the bosses ever saw us doing that, we'd have gotten in trouble, but we never did. I went in the front office one day, and I got my orders in there, and I picked up a few orders, and I was going to fill these paint orders, and this young lady was sitting at the counter there, and she was looking up at me, and I was wearing this little bell around my neck with a leather strap, and she asked me, she says, "Why are you wearing that bell around your neck?" And I said, well, the only answer I had at the time was, "Well, that's so you can find me if the lights go out, you know." So, and her eyes went, lit up, and the next thing I know, I was getting notes from her all day long from everybody in the paint factory with her name and her phone number on it, "Let's go out." So that Friday, we went across the tracks and went to the this little bar on the corner. It was called the Blue Room, and come to find out that her father used to frequent this bar from time to time. Now, if you've ever been to North Chicago, there's a bar on every corner. You know, you can't get away from that. So we'd go in there, we'd cash our checks, you know, buy a beer, cash the checks, play a little pool, go home. I went ahead and cashed my check. Got my beer, put the money in my pocket, and I found all these notes that they had been sending me all day long. So I said, "Well, I'll go ahead and ask her out." So I made the call. I said, "Would you like to go out tomorrow?" And she said, "Sure." So I went over there the next day and knocked on her apartment door, and out came this little old man, and he leaned over to me, and he says, "You better be good to her, or I'll kick your ass." And I thought, wow, this is not a good start, you know. I don't even know this guy. And a minute later, she came to the door and invited me in. And there was these three little kids playing on the floor. And they were throwing toys at me. And I thought, well, she must be babysitting. But I come to find out they were her kids. And I didn't think too much about it, because I love kids anyway. And I always have a good time with them. I had a lot of fun. So we went out. After the babysitter came, we went out to a movie. And the movie, she calls it this ever-romantic movie of Deliverance. So, yeah, I know. But that was out. That was one of the new movies out then. And I didn't, with, you know, Burt Reynolds and John Boyd. And I didn't really know what the content of the movie at the time. But she actually kept dating me. And a couple weeks later, I moved in. And I became the built-in babysitter, because she had a second job in order to support the family. She had worked in the this little lounge called the Turf Club. It was a little lounge right off of the bowling alley. Well, we were clicking right along, and I decided, well, I'll ask my friends what they think about her, you know, because I think I might ask her to marry me. And they said, well, yeah, you know, she's really cool. You'll probably work out real good with her. And I said, oh, okay, well, thanks for the input. And that was the end of that. A week later, we went up to the hills to go inner tubing on the snow, and the guys were in the car with us, and they were shooting their mouths off, and the one friend of mine said, "Well, you set the wedding date. When you getting married?" And I looked at him and I said, "You've got to be kidding me. I hadn't even asked her yet." And he's shooting his mouth off. And I looked over to her and her eyes are big and wide. And I think, "Oh, crap, now I'm stuck." And not really, but I said, "Yeah, I was going to ask you to marry me." And she says, "Yes." And I said, "Oh, okay." Now, you know, my first wife, I think she married me because of the fact that she needed to get out of her household. Her father was a daily drinker, you know. Whenever I used to go, I'm just backtracking a little bit. Whenever I used to go over to her house, that man would drink a fifth of gin every night. And I asked her, does he drink so much? And she says, "Well, that's nothing. He carries one under his car seat, too." So that man, as far as I know, that guy is still alive, and he's probably pickled by now, but... I think that's why she married me in the first place, you know. I have since made amends to her, by the way. She was on my list. Anyway, moving right along. So we decided to make our plans of getting married, and where was it? Did I say how the guy said that? Yes, we didn't. So anyway, kind of skipping around a little bit there. Asked her to marry me, and we decided to get married in the woods. So we got married in these woods called Van Patten Woods. And she was wearing a gauze dress with her hair done up with flowers in it, you know. And I was wearing the big old white bell bottoms and long hair and, you know, hippie dime type dress, I guess you could call it, in those days. And we had a friend of ours play acoustic guitar, Strawberry Fields Forever. And after the ceremony, we passed out daisies and doobies to everyone. So, and you know, I'm no Mr. Clean either. I have done a few things in my lifetime, so, and I'm sure all of you had too. So, anyway, that night we decided to go up north, and we went to a Indian reservation for our honeymoon. We didn't have any money, hardly, so we only had enough money for a bag of jelly beans, and that's what we ate. So that's all you really need on a honeymoon anyway, is a little sugar to keep you going, right? But so we came home and started making plans on coming back to California. We loaded up the trailer with the bikes in the back and the kids in the car. Into the 65 Ramblers that used to spit ice cubes out. The air conditioner was so good. And we loaded up the dog named Narc and headed to California. It's all falling into place now, right? Well, we got out to California, and I got a job right away at this transmission parts warehouse. And I hooked up with the bikers right away, and that's my scene. I love motorcycles, and we had a lot of fun, you know. Did a lot of partying. A lot of stuff was not conducive to family life, I don't think. And but they all had families with kids and that, and they didn't seem any worse for the wear, so I figured it was okay, you know. We ended up going down Friday nights to the Long Beach down at the Pike, and we used to drink at the Checkerboard when it was still there. And Saturday nights we'd take the wives down and we'd drink there too. And at the end of the night we'd throw money into a hat and go two blocks over to Bert Grimm's and get tattoos. So, I mean, it's just part of nostalgia down there. It's not like that anymore, but that's what we used to do. And, you know, I'm not a drinker, but I love the camaraderie. And what I did was my whole time when I was with the bikers, and that was that I'd always buy the first beer for myself. And something I could sip on, and then all my friends really liked me a lot, and they'd always buy me beers, and they'd line them up on the bar. So what I would do is I'd go around the bar, BSing with everybody, you know, having a good time, socializing, and when I got to the bathroom, I'd go in there and pour it out. Come out, put the empty down, grab another one. And I'd do that all night long. I used to do this all the time when I went out with the guys, and they never caught on to me, ever. But that's their fault of wasting all that money on beer. But that was part of my life there. Kathy, you know, I was focusing mostly on my kids. They were started to do crazy things and drinking and partying. And I wasn't focusing on my wife too much, although she was drinking pretty heavily and doing her thing. And some of the parties, she'd be drinking her peppermint schnapps and tequila, and she'd buy every raffle ticket for wine bottles she could get her hands on. And I remember this one raffle, she spent, $20-$30 and won about a dozen bottles of her favorite wine, you know, Ripple and Boone's Farm, and we used to call her the wino. But I still wasn't focusing on her, even with all that partying around. I remember her even falling across the seat of the pickup truck with her head hanging out the door, puking blood, and I didn't say too much to her except, "Don't you think you've had a little too much?" So I wasn't really focusing on her. I was focusing on the kids. I kept getting in trouble. More and more things used to happen. You know, the kids were stealing from us every time we turned around. They stole my camera out of my camera bag and put a brick in it so I wouldn't know it was gone. They were crawling around on the floors at night trying to find my wallet and their mom's purse. We had to hide them. And oh, man, it was just on and on and on. The one thing they really broke my heart on was I had had this trunk of antique trains that was handed down from my father's father to him, and he handed it down to me, and I was going to hand it down to the kids when they were ready. And I'd always set it up during Christmas time. And I went and drug this chest down, and it was light. And so I opened it up, and I found a bunch of empty Lionel boxes and track in there, and it just broke my heart. I couldn't believe my kids would do such a thing because they knew how much it meant to me. But, you know, I went through a lot of turmoil and emotional stuff over that, and the kids were just running amok and going crazy. The next one down was starting to rob houses. He had robbed like 12 to 14 houses before he finally got busted. He was carrying dog biscuits in one pocket and a pair of extra socks in the other pocket for gloves. And spent a lot of time in halfway houses. No, not halfway houses, but juvenile places, you know. Some of them even out here, I think. And then sent him to a rehab place for a while to behavior modification. That was a nice 40 grand ticket. He didn't learn nothing out of that except how to work the streets. You know, there was a lot of resentment there that I had that I carried through to into Al-Anon. And it's just something I had to work with. I say we a lot because my wife and me were partners in all this stuff. We used to fight a lot too, you know. Until we got on the same page, things were not working good for us. You know, she'd discipline the kids and then she'd turn around and say, "Okay, I'm tired of doing it, it's your turn." And I said, "Okay, now I got the lead, turn me loose." So when I handed down punishment, she came to me and said, "Aren't you a little tough on them?" You know, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm getting this mixed message and I don't understand, you know. So I was feeling a lot of self-worth that wasn't there. You know, it was just gone. Would take vacations, you know. Always have enough booze and drugs to go on a vacation, but never enough food, it seemed like. Just one of those things, you know. It's crazy, just crazy. My brother, who used to throw rocks at me and that, he moved out here to California, and he got hooked up with this lady who ran a bar. And this lady, he married her, and she looked just as old as my mom. And I tell you, from my own personal experience, I think she was an alcoholic, although she never said she was. But whenever I was around her, she smelled like booze, and then whenever she came over the house, she would drink perfume to cover the smell of booze around my wife, which she didn't have to, but she did. And later on, she contracted brain cancer and passed away. It was a sad time. The kids kept getting worse and worse on their drugs and alcohol. They'd go out and party a lot. Michael would go out and he'd start having blackouts, my oldest son, and he'd come back and he'd pee in the corner and pee on the bed, pee in the hallway, and you know, at the same time we had this little puppy and it was peeing in the corner and peeing in the bed, peeing in the hallway. We actually threw them both out. dog to the backyard, him to his roll motel out front because his car broke down. And at least we knew where he was at, you know. He could come in once in a while and shower up, and we'd give him a sandwich to make sure he was still alive. His alcoholism progressed, and we started saving money for his funeral because we didn't think he'd survive. That was a pretty sad time. Before they left, though, I mean, they kept doing their deals before I kicked them out of the house. And the youngest one was doing a lot of drugs and alcohol, too. And they had gone out one night, and I told them, I said, you know, I don't want you guys going out and getting all stoned and jacked up, and don't come back here. I'll kick your butt, you know. And in one ear and out the other, you know. They came in about midnight, and I was there sitting in a chair waiting for them. Youngest one came in. He saw me. I got up out of the chair, headed for him. He hit the floor, and I kicked him in the ass and got him out of the way. And then the oldest one came through the door. And, you know, we talk about in Al-Anon about that anger we have sometimes where we just, you blank out, you don't know what happened because you're so furious. It's like that white hot anger. Well, I grabbed that kid with both my hands, and I threw him to the floor, and I started beating him with both hands. And I didn't stop until the bones in my right hand started breaking. And I'm not proud of that. It was a terrible time in my life because I love my kids. But at that time, I did not. And next morning, I'm in bedroom, ice packs on my hand, getting ready to go to the ER to get it taken care of. And he comes tripping through the hallway, leans in the room and says, "Hey, Dad, what's wrong with you?" You know, I didn't even hurt him. No cuts, no bruises, no nothing. You know me, I don't lie. I never have lied, I never will. And I went down to the ER, and they asked me how I broke my hand. I told them I broke my hand on my kid. They immediately put a hold on me, and Child Services was called in. They got my address, and they sent the representatives over to interview the kid and to make sure he was okay. And an hour later, they came back when I was getting released, and they said, "Sorry, Mr. Wilkes, you were right. You're kid does need help." And I said, "See, I told you." You know, it's a shame I had to learn that lesson by breaking my hand over this situation. But, you know, we do crazy things in Al-Anon trying to keep things going. I used to strip search my kids every morning, literally strip search my kids every morning so they wouldn't steal anything from us. And I wanted to make sure that they go to school without any drugs or anything. It was crazy, you know. And then I'd go through all their drawers, all their clothes, pockets, everything. Everywhere I think I could hide something myself, I would look for to where they would. You know, I thought that maybe they'd never be able to hide anything from me. Well, that went on and on and on, and finally the kids started getting really, really bad, and Michael, we finally kicked him out, and he was off on his own, and he ended up going into a little room behind a garage. It was right across the street from a liquor store. And it was perfect for him. He taped up all the windows shut so nobody could see in, and he could isolate and do whatever he needed to do. And he could go back and forth to the liquor store and get whatever he needed. We were really worried about that kid. Eventually he came by the house and asked for help. And, you know, they always tell us to keep your mind open and listen. And that's what I did. And I heard something different in his voice one day when he asked for help. And what I ended up doing was, at the time he asked that question, I was able to hand him a sheet of paper with phone numbers of halfway houses and stuff. And I said, "You make the call." And he made the call, and we let him stay the night and shower up. And I took him down the next morning and dropped him off. And that was his beginning into recovery. Now, the other one went amok. Joey was the youngest of the first three oldest. And by the way, we had another kid when we moved to California. So now I have four boys. And our house was like a schoolhouse at any given time. You know, each one of them had two or three friends each. So it was common to see a lot of kids in and out of the house. Joey, after his little stints in the juvenile and all that, he ended up getting busted for interstate drug trafficking and conspiracy to commit murder. He got 22 and a half years sentence in federal prison. And today he's doing well. He's educated himself, and he's in prison right now. He's got 11 years sobriety, got that on his own, and he'll be getting out soon. So he went in a young man, and he's going to be coming out an old man. And it's a shame that he lost all that time. But before he went in there, you know, we had he called his mother one day. Mother came home. She talked to him. He wanted to commit suicide. So she called me up at work. I put on my Superman outfit and flew home. And just another one of those things, you know. And I asked him, I said, well, what's the deal here? Where's this guy at? And told me where he was at. I called him up, and I said, you know, come on over. We'll pay you off. Leave the kid alone. So I don't know about you guys. Most drug people don't take checks, but this guy did. We paid off the bill that the kid owed, and you know how things work. Oh, everything's okay now, Pop. You know, nothing's going to be bad anymore. I'm going to get better. Well, that's wrong. It did not. Kid went to, the kid didn't go anywhere. He was at home. Kathy went back to work, crying all the time, got a hold of her boss. Her boss took her to her boss and introduced her to him. And this man who had 16 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, he helped us out big time. He set us up in a rehab place in Tucson, Arizona called Cottonwood. You know, that's where they send doctors and airplane pilots and kids like mine. And that seemed to work real well. You know, it was right around Christmas time and that, and they called up and they said, well, why don't you come down here for family week? And I said, no. Fix him up, send him home. I said, it's his problem, not mine. I don't want nothing to do with it. And they said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to come down here as part of the program and as part of the recovery. So we ended up going down, which I didn't really want to. I had a big resentment over the whole situation because all the stuff that went down. And they gave us homework when we got there. The homework was, here's a sheet of paper. We want you to write all the good things about the kid on one side and all the bad things about the kid on the other. And I said, all right, fine. And I thought, well, this is my time to really show him what I really think about what's going on. And I felt real self-righteous about the thing, you know. So next morning in the class there, they had all the chairs around in the room and the two chairs in the center. I said, all right, Mr. Wilkes, you're up first. So I went and sat down and sat my kid across from me, and they said, okay, read your sheet of paper. So I read all the good things about him. And then I read all the bad things, which was like tenfold. And I felt really good about it. I figured this is going to make an impact on this kid. And they said, okay. I said, okay, thank you, Mr. Wilson. So I said, okay, Joe, it's your turn. And then what I didn't know was they gave him the same homework assignment they gave us. So he read back to me all the things he liked about me and all the things he disliked about me. And it was a real eye-opener for me that I really wasn't the father that I thought I was. You know, and it was starting to be a turning point in my life, this family weekend at this rehab place. Well, they said that we want you guys to go to an Al-Anon meeting. We're going to have one here. It's a mandatory meeting you got to go to before you leave here. And when you get back to Los Angeles, you need to go to 6 meetings. Well, we saw the steps on the wall. There's 12 of them. 2 steps per meeting, we're out of there, right? Seemed logical to me. So this lady came to share with us, and she shared what happened that night. She was living with an active alcoholic. She asked me to come home so she could go to dinner with him and so she could fulfill her commitment. He did that. He did just that. He came home, but he fell in drunk, fell on the floor, passed out. So she covered him up with a blanket, called her friend, and they went out to dinner. And then she came to the meeting and shared her experience, strength, and hope with us. When she shared that, I thought to myself, you know, she's got something that I want. Because she can be happy whether the alcohol is drinking or not, and I'm not happy. There's something I don't know or I don't have, and I need to know what it is. So when we got back to Los Angeles, we got a hold of AA, and they got a hold of Al-Anon Force, and they hooked us up with this man named Gene Walker. He's since passed away. We used to call him Crazy Gene. And he hooked us up with a step study home meeting. And it was run by Larson and Butch at the time. And that's where I really blossomed in Al-Anon. I wasn't like the second meeting I had gone to, and I was on my way home, and I turned to my wife, and I told her I wasn't going to take any more of her crap anymore. And she said, "You're not going to any more meetings either." But but that's okay, you know. She eventually found her own meetings, and I kept going because I felt good there. Every time I go to a meeting, I feel better afterwards, and no matter how crappy I feel. So that was a real turning point for me again, you know. I'm a real quick learner. I learned the steps really fast, and I started feeling better and better, and my life just started blossoming. Over the years, I had to take care of my parents. Mom and Dad were getting elderly. Mom's 87, and Dad was 98. They lived up in Puget Sound, Washington. I had to go up there one summer, and come to find out that Dad was blind in one eye and couldn't see too well out of the other one, and he was using Mom as a co-pilot to drive town. And I said, "That's it. I'm taking your keys away," and that damn near killed him because he's all for freedom and everything. And I hated to do that. I felt a little guilty about that. And then when I told him I was moving him down to Los Angeles to take care of him, that did not go well either. I had to really talk him into that. And when he left the house for the last time and locked the door, and he turned around and faced me, he was crying, and it just broke my heart. I mean, I got such a guilt trip over that. Thank God for Al-Anon to help me out on that. I had to do a lot of writing and working out with my sponsor on that one because I felt really bad. You know, I knew I was doing the best thing for him, but it was just one of those things that had to be done. Dad journaled a lot. He was a real heavy-duty journaler, and remember I told you I didn't think anybody had any alcoholism in our family? Well, I read his journals after we got him down here, and I come to find out that Dad used to journal about his drinking, and he journaled about how much he drank, what the effects were, and what he needed to do to clean his system up by taking laxatives and enemas and to flush his system out so he could start all over again. I never knew that, you know, until I read it in the book. Later on, when he was close to passing away, he shared with me about the family history, too, which is another thing I didn't know about. My uncle passed away from acute pancreatitis, direct result from alcoholism. And the one thing that really shocked me was my grandfather, which I never met, blew his brains out on the front porch because of alcoholism. I never knew that, and Dad kept it a secret. We're only as sick as our secrets, I keep saying, and that's a fact. Never shared that with the family until it was his time. As time went on here in Al-Anon, I've been very fortunate to have the ability to sponsor people, and it's been a big growth period in my lifetime. I'm really happy about that. I love sharing with my guys and offering them suggestions so they can have solutions to fix their problems or work out whatever they need to do. You know, I love how the things are progressing with the guys in Al-Anon. This is a big meeting in Al-Anon here for guys. I'm really impressed. Ours is only about 30, 35 guys. We started that, Gary and me, years ago, and because we didn't like some of the other meetings we went to. We felt they weren't doing it the right way. You know, you know how that goes. And not working your way, start your own. And then that's just the way it is. I want to talk about Al-Anon a little bit. You know, when I came in Al-Anon, there wasn't very many men in here. There's only a couple of guys, and one guy left, and I was left by myself. But I felt really comfortable with the older ladies in the rooms. They used to really take care of me and kind of mother me a little bit. I didn't mind that one bit, and they were really nice. They were telling me, you know, you're no good to anybody else until you start taking care of yourself. You know, that's bottom line. Remember, no is a complete sentence. I used to laugh at that all the time. They said, you got to be a parent, not a friend to your kids. Somebody has to be the authoritative figure in the family. kept reinforcing this stuff over and over and over again. You know? And I picked up a lot of the stuff from him that I wasn't doing that I thought I was doing. When I kicked my one young son out, the one that got arrested eventually for drug trafficking, he used to live off the streets and dig through the dumpsters and that. And he would dig through the dumpster behind this one Al-Anon lady's house. And she would call in from time to time and give me information on how he's doing. Yeah, I saw him out here. He was digging through the dumpster. He looks okay. This world's small, you know. You can't get around. What was the other thing he said? Yeah, make sure you say what you mean and mean what you say, you know. I remember a lot of times I used to tell the kids, do as I say, not as I do. That was a mixed message that didn't work well for the kids. You know, I swear to God, I'm surprised they're alive today. They all have various times of sobriety now. The oldest one has 17 years sobriety. I'm surprised he made it. He was the one we were saving money for to bury. Joey has 11 years, like I said, sobriety. My wife has 27 years in Al-Anon and 26 years in AA. And she joined shortly the AA program because when she was doing her four-step in Al-Anon, it didn't quite look good on the four-step about drinking all the stuff she was drinking. So she ended up having to go to AA. But that was great. I remember her first meeting. She came back home and she says, well, I went to an AA meeting tonight. I says, yeah. And she says, I raised my hand as a newcomer. I says, it's about time. She looked at me like it was a surprise, you know.
You knew?
Oh, yeah. Life and times. What Al-Anon has taught me, especially with my parents, was acceptance, tolerance, compassion. You know, without those, I would have never been able to handle my parents. When I first moved them down, I thought I could take care of them myself, and it was very, very difficult. They had various degrees of medical assistance that they needed, and it was just too much on me. So I ended up having to get them in assisted living. When they finally did reach their time to pass away, Mom was the first to go, and it's been in the last 5 years. And we never have to be alone here in Al-Anon. That's what I love about this program, because I have so many friends and so many cherished memories of stuff. You know, the guys are always there for me, and I'm always there for them. And they came to the hospital room, and I had my sponsor and two sponsees sitting on the floor when my mom passed away. They were there with me to support me. And when my dad passed away 7 months later, my sponsor was there too. So, I mean, that's what we do for each other here in Al-Anon, and I am truly grateful for that. You know, it has changed my life tremendously. It's nothing but good. I can tell you nothing but good since I've been here. I've only told you a few stories of my life, and there's many, many, many more, but I don't have time for all these things. You'd be here all night. I like the idea of sponsoring the guys. You know, they remind me of how it used to be and how I used to be, you know. And I'm not too far from the tree, you know, where the apple falls. I remember a lot of stuff that I used to do that was not conducive to family life. All my cursing and yelling and screaming at the kids all the time. Breaking their stuff. Not mine, theirs. Kicking holes in walls. You know, I figured I tried all these crazy things to try and get their attention so they would mind me and do what I told them, you know. That's where that scenario came in, do as I say, not as I do. You know, I never patched the one hole in the hallway in my house because I left it there as a memory after I got into Al-Anon because I wanted to remember how things were. And that hole remained there for about 10 years before I finally patched it and said, I don't need to look at that anymore. It's done. Yeah, we do crazy things in this world. Al-Anon's been one blessing for me. That's all I can tell you. It's been one big blessing for me. I know I haven't talked a whole bunch tonight. I was planning on talking a long time. There's a lot of stuff, but they say when you're done, you're done. You know. I don't have all those friends I used to have in when I was biking around. They were not true friends. The true friends I have here are in the program. You know, Al-Anon and AA as well. I've got more friends in AA, I think, than I do in Al-Anon, because I go to the speaker meeting on Saturday night, and it's an open forum. And I got a lot of friends in there. A lot of them are transitioning over to Al-Anon, too. I don't know how it is in this room, but we see that a lot in our Al-Anon rooms, too. And I think it's about damn time. You know, you guys are sick. So anyway, no disrespect. I remember this one time when my kid was running amok and drinking a lot. He skipped out of school and jumped the wall behind our house. He got a hold of some spray cans and he's spray painting on a neighbor's brick wall. I don't know, whatever he thought he was doing was an art. Next thing I know, I got the neighbors yelling at me, you know, your son did this and your son did that. And I couldn't believe that, because I he went to school. I said, well, let me wait till tomorrow. I'll call the school and see if he was there. You know, but before that turned around, when I was cleaning up the backyard and I went to empty trash, I found the trash can full of empty beer bottles and cans. And I knew it wasn't me, because I wasn't drinking. So I ended up confronting the kid, and he finally confessed to it, and I made him go apologize to the neighbor. And that was a scene to remember, because he was cussed him out and really kind of shamed me a little bit about that. Anyway, I told the neighbors I'd hire a truck to sandblast their wall off and clean it up for them, and I did. And that was just another one of those things that we had to put up with the kid. On and on and on. The other two sons I had are pot smokers. They're like those little bobblehead dogs in the back of the window, you know? Yeah. They still do that from time to time. One of them just got clean and sober. He's been about 7 months now. He hasn't done anything. He's cleaned his act up. He just got married this last year, and I guess he finally decided he has to start growing up and being an adult and stepping up to the plate. So I'm really proud of him about that. The other one, I don't know about him. He's 45 years old now, and he's still doing his thing, and I don't know if he'll ever get away from that stuff. But there's always hope. We'll pray for him. There's always a seat open. I want to thank David for asking me. Where are you, David? There. Thank you for coming up and sharing with you guys. It's a real honor to share for Al-Anon. And my greatest saying is, I'd rather eat ground glass than share in front of my peers. And that's the truth. You know, it scares the crap out of me. And I've had to work through a lot of 10 steps with my sponsor over that. Well, one-on-one, I can talk your ear off. But when I have to face all my peers, it's a different story. And there's no reason for that, because my story is my story. You know, I mean, I lived it. I know how it is. But that's just how it is with me. That fear factor is always there. I do appreciate you being so quiet and listening to me. Thank you for allowing me to come up here and participate in my recovery. It really means a lot to me. And thank you for being here, for sharing in your recovery, too. That's also a great thing. That being said, I think I'm done. Thank you.
much.
Can I ask Scott to come up and read us the closing prayer?
Good evening, I'm Scott. In closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you liked and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. If you try to keep an open mind, you will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. That's a really important part of this. Talk to each other, reason things out with someone else, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Will all who care to please join me with the Serenity Prayer? God,
grant you serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you work it and work it.
Thank you. Good job, man.
Very nice here.
Good to speak. A good crowd, man.
Yeah.
So cool.
All right.
Great job, man.